Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our weekly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today are Semantic Threat Researchers Bridget O'Gorman and Candid West. So in this week's podcast, we'll be discussing a cyber attack targeting the UK general election campaign, how a smart doorbell from Amazon could leak your Wi-Fi password, an update on the legality of US border officials asking visitors to unlock their phones, and a malicious spam campaign masquerading as WebEx invites. But first, do you use routers made by Ubiquiti Networks? If so, you may be interested in a story that broke late last week. That's because the company found itself dealing with a blizzard of privacy-related complaints after it rolled out a firmware update which began collecting telemetry from the products. The update was to its Unify wireless routers, and it configured them to create a secure connection back to Ubiquiti servers and upload information about performance and crashes. Now, that itself is fairly common practice across the entire technology industry, and similar systems are used by a whole host of hardware and software vendors. Ubiquiti has said that all data being handled is being handled securely, and the program has been cleared to comply with Europe's GDPR data protection regulations. And so that means that any data collected is completely anonymized, GDPR compliant, transmitted using end-to-end encryption, and encrypted at rest, it said. So the collection of this data does not or should not ever impact on the performance of your devices, Ubiquiti said. However, that's not what annoyed some of its customers. They said they weren't notified of the change, nor was their permission sought. And that does seem to be at variance with what the usual practice is when this kind of data is gathered, namely that the user is notified of this and frequently given the option of opting out of any such data collection. And the controversy caused by the firmware update does seem to have prompted Ubiquiti to alter its course somewhat, because it has promised to release a firmware update which will allow customers to opt out of data collection. Though no release date has been published yet, but you'd expect that it's going to be on the way sooner rather than later. Now, on to politics, because Bridget has some news from the general election campaign that is currently well underway in the UK.
Yes, so for any of our listeners who aren't aware, the UK is facing yet another general election on the 12th of December this year, so not too far away at all. And as for, you know, all intents and purposes, the UK, similar to the US, really has more or less a two-party system. In the main, it's a competition between the Conservative Party, who are currently in power and who are, of course, led by Boris Johnson, and the Labour Party, who are led by Jeremy Corbyn. So basically, those two parties are fighting it out as to who will be the biggest party and hence in a position to form a government after the 12th of December. So obviously, with all those factors in play, it's a pretty hotly contested contest. And obviously, the results of it are going to have a big impact on, of course, the future of Brexit that we talked so much about for the last couple of years. So with all that in mind, obviously, election security is something that, of course, has been to the forefront and is very important, obviously, in an election campaign like this. And obviously as well, given the many kind of allegations and rumours we've heard about foreign interference in the Brexit campaign back in 2016, it's probably not surprising that, you know, many British politicians are feeling a bit paranoid about the possibility of outside forces, I suppose, messing with their campaign for election. And given all those kind of factors, there was consternation ensued earlier this week when the Labour Party issued a statement saying that its digital platforms had been hit by what it described as a sophisticated and large-scale cyber attack. And this, of course, led to immediate reactions on Twitter, naturally, with much talk of interference and sabotage quickly picking up steam on the platform.
Yeah, I mean, you can see why this would instantly get the public's attention. The election itself is probably going to be, or could be, as important as the Brexit referendum originally, and given the impact of previous cyber attacks against political campaigns, it could be fairly serious. But what do we know about this cyber attack and who was behind it?
Yeah, so as it turns out, describing it as sophisticated may have been, you know, the wrong adjective to use there.
Okay.
You know, as you say, Dick, obviously, you know, cyber attacks can have big impacts, but this was, in fact, just a DDoS attack. So basically, the website was just flooded with traffic to such a degree that it slowed down the website and impacted some people's ability to access it. Now, the Labour Party reportedly uses Cloudflare's DDoS mitigation services, and it seems in the main they worked to mitigate most of the effects of the attack. And in its own statement, the Labour Party said that it took swift action and that attempts to disrupt its digital platforms failed due to its, quote, robust security systems. Now, the original attack happened on Monday, and it seems that the website was once again flooded with traffic on Tuesday after news of the original attack was revealed, which is something we do kind of see with DDoS attacks, that, you know, people kind of go after them again once they hear that they've been targeted. And this did lead to the party's website being slowed down and inaccessible for some people for like a short period of time on Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to belittle DDoS attacks because they in themselves are quite serious, but it is of a different order of magnitude or lesser order of magnitude compared to some of the cyber attacks we saw, say, targeting the US presidential election in 2016.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the issue is kind of that this attack was described multiple times as sophisticated, you know, when in fact a script kiddie really can carry out a DDoS attack with relative ease. You know, there's lots of botnets out there now that are fairly freely available for people to leverage for things like this. So really this attack, it wasn't very sophisticated. And there is in fact no evidence that it was part of any kind of bigger coordinated takedown attempt or the result of any kind of foreign interference. It could just as easily have been some kid messing around. And I suppose describing attacks like this as sophisticated when they aren't, and there's no evidence of any more kind of coordinated campaign around the attack, you know, really just serves to kind of confuse people and, you know, spread a certain paranoia that may not even be anyway warranted.
Yeah, I mean, it does probably, there's an element of boy who cried wolf, you know, if every single attack generates these kind of headlines, that maybe when a serious attack does happen, and hopefully it won't, then people mightn't register the gravity of it when it happens.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, obviously, you know, we need to be vigilant in the run up to elections like this, particularly after some of the activity, you know, that you've outlined there that we've seen in the last few years. But, you know, as there is no evidence of anything more than a simple DDoS attack, it seems there's no need for panic just yet. And the National Cyber Security Centre in the UK said that the incident is now closed. But we will keep an eye, of course, on what's happening in the UK in the next few weeks, because, of course, there is still nearly a month to election day. So we'll see if any sophisticated cyber attacks actually do happen between now and then. Hopefully not, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, we'll keep our fingers crossed for everyone in the UK, because this is probably the last thing they need, given everything else that they have going on, you know. Now on to something completely different, because Candid, you've been looking at a story that popped up into the news this week about Amazon's Ring video doorbell, because it's found that it could leak your Wi-Fi password to attackers. Is this a case of yet another insecure IoT device?
Well, so security researchers at Bitdefender had a look at the Amazon Ring video doorbell. And this is one of those smart doorbell devices that actually allows the owner to check and, of course, chat with the people that are ringing the door. And in order for this to work, the doorbell needs to be connected to a Wi-Fi, or probably more the internet per se. Because otherwise, the owner cannot, of course, make use of the remote connection feature. And the issue that the researchers found lies in the configuration setup. So like with many IoT devices, in order to set it up, the device will be booted as a Wi-Fi access point. And that's quite a common practice for IoT devices. You push a button, they start an open access point, and then the user can connect with the smartphone app to the device and configure things like the Wi-Fi network name, but of course also the Wi-Fi network credentials so that they can connect to it afterwards. And, well, those are exactly the things in the issue, because here the communication is made in plain text over HTTP, so it's not encrypted, hence it's quite easy for an attacker, which stands nearby, to sniff the connection, which also contains the user Wi-Fi password, and then that can be used for a later attack. So, unfortunately, that's a common weakness, and I have seen a few devices myself that have the same issue here. And as we all know, once the attacker has the password for the home network, they could start scanning the network for other devices and potentially attack computers or IoT devices inside your home network. And there are quite a few devices that will allow full access as long as you are in the same trusted local network. And I guess with a smart door lock, it can, of course, also mean that you can open the door to anybody, including yourself.
Okay. Now, the thing that jumps out to me here about this one, Candid, is that it means the credentials are only leaked during the initial configuration process, which means any potential attacker has a very small window to take advantage of this, and they may not, you know, they'd also need to know when the person is setting up the device. Is a vulnerability like this in any way significant?
Yeah, it's actually correct. The attack only works during the window of the setup phase, right? So this probably doesn't happen too often, and the attacker needs to be nearby in order to sniff the whole network traffic. So it is definitely not as bad as, let's say, a remote code execution against a network-connected camera, which unfortunately we have seen with other products before. So the researchers came up with a scenario that could help them, let's say, if you have an already configured doorbell, to still attack it. An attacker can send deauthentication packets through the or against the Wi-Fi network, which basically will lead to the doorbell being dropped by the Wi-Fi. And that means the device itself will then show up as being offline in your smartphone app. And this could potentially lead to the owner starting to reboot the device and eventually trying to reset and then restart the configuration process, which is exactly what the attacker wants. But I'm not fully convinced that this is very practical, as, I mean, it might take a while for the user to notice that the device is no longer online, depending on how many visitors you get. And if the owner is on, let's say, a 2 weeks vacation, the attacker would need to wait as well in order to not miss the initialization setup, right? Of course, you could argue the attackers could create something like a Raspberry Pi device that automatically performs the deauthentication attack, stops once the device gets offline, and then sniffs the network traffic for the credentials. And if connected to a very, very large battery pack and then stored in the bushes near the doorbell, this could potentially work. But I still guess it does not really scale too well. And luckily, the vendor actually fixed the vulnerability in the newest update, so at least if the device is up to date, it should no longer work.
Yeah, I mean, that's a potentially more feasible exploit scenario, but it still requires an awful lot of work on the part of the attacker, and they probably also have to monitor the user quite closely. But I guess this is an illustration of how updates to hardware are always really important. And also, did this doorbell have a similar issue before? It rings a bell with me.
Yes, absolutely. There was actually a case in 2016 where researcher already noticed that you can simply walk up to the doorbell, use a screwdriver, and kind of remove it from the wall. And there's a small button at the back of it, which is exactly the button you press to set it into setup mode. So it's hidden at the back, but still accessible as it's outside of your home. And once this is done, the attacker can then use the access point to connect to the web server and access the current network configuration by simply browsing to a local known URL. So this would then reveal the saved Wi-Fi passwords in clear text. And of course, this URL was plain HTTP as well, so no big surprises there. Back then, the vendor actually fixed it by no longer revealing the password through that website, but it shows also that there were probably a few more things that should have been fixed at the time.
Yeah, indeed. Now, what should users do about this apart from, you know, obviously applying the update to their devices?
Well, I guess one additional thing that users can do is use a different VLAN, like a guest Wi-Fi, for such, let's say, quote-unquote, untrusted devices or IoT devices. That way, even if the Wi-Fi network gets compromised or the IoT device gets compromised itself, it would not lead to the complete home network being infiltrated. Of course, I'm aware that it's not always easy nor convenient to segregate all the devices into smaller networks, as some IoT devices might need to interact with other devices. So it might be difficult, but at least if you want to make use of the full potential, you probably should think about how you do setup.
Okay. Now let's move on, because Bridget, you want to give us some new information related to a few stories that we've talked about previously on the podcast.
Yeah, so we've discussed, I think, a few times over the last year since we started this podcast about incidents of border police in the US seizing and seeking access to people's electronic devices when they're entering the country. And often this is, you know, for no kind of obvious, clear reason. And we have certainly discussed previous court cases which were taken to determine whether people could be compelled to unlock their devices in such instances or hand over their PINs or things like that. And the issue with the border in the US is that it has always kind of been deemed to be able to operate under slightly different rules to the rest of the country, because the fact that the agents there are tasked with protecting America's borders. So while it has previously been ruled in a separate court case that warrantless search and seizure of the digital contents of a mobile phone or a cell phone during someone's arrest is unconstitutional, it hasn't been clear if similar rules apply to people actually entering the country.
Okay, and have we got any more insight onto the legality or illegality of these practices now?
Yes, so a ruling issued by a Massachusetts judge on Tuesday has declared that the seizure and search of phones and laptops and other electronic devices at the US border is in fact unconstitutional. Now, Judge Denise Casper said that such practices break the Fourth Amendment of the US Constitution, which covers unreasonable search. And she said that border agents need to have a reasonable suspicion of illegal activity before they can search electronic devices. However, the judge didn't go so far as to issue an injunction to require border agents to get a warrant before searching such devices or to have the legally defined probable cause before doing so. So this does mean that officials at the border can still search devices, but they will now need to be able to have some justification for doing so. So the judge was ruling in a case that was brought by privacy rights advocates and also by 11 plaintiffs who had had their phones or devices searched at the US border. And 10 of those 11 plaintiffs are US citizens, while the other is a permanent resident. So it's not just the case that it was visitors to the country that were being impacted by these practices. But following this ruling, it's not entirely clear now if this ruling will apply to all visitors to the US, so people just visiting on tourist visas or similar, or will it just apply to citizens and residents? However, lawyers at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who were spoken to by the media following this ruling, have argued that logic would dictate that all visitors arriving in the US should be granted kind of the equal protections and be under the same rules in that sense. So this really means basically that if phones are now searched without reasonable suspicion being demonstrated, any evidence that is found on them would be thrown out by a judge at a subsequent trial, or if it is an innocent party's phone was searched without reasonable suspicion, they could then potentially sue, which is obviously something that people worry about a lot. And while it is almost certain that this ruling will be appealed to the Supreme Court, until such time as that happens, these rules on reasonable suspicion will apply on the border. So in that sense, it is a good day and a good week for privacy advocates.
Okay, so by the sounds of it, yeah, they're going to have to think carefully before they ask anybody to unlock their devices. So let's see where that goes in the Supreme Court. Now, on to a completely different topic. It concerns another spam campaign, which is misusing open web redirects to add trust. And this time, the WebEx brand is being misused. Candid, what's this one all about?
Yeah, so open web redirects are URLs that automatically forward to a different URL that can be specified by the creator of the link. So there are quite a few websites that allow the target of the redirect to be any website, which per se is not malicious. But of course, it can be used by attackers, as it allows an attacker to have a link that looks like it is the legitimate brand. And once you click on it or the victim clicks on it, you will be redirected to a potential malicious site, which could be something like a phishing website. And this tactic has been seen many, many times in spam campaigns, as it can, of course, help to boost the reputation of the link in emails, and people are more likely to click on a link if there is a trusted domain below it. In the newest spam campaign, an email is sent that looks like a WebEx invite for a meeting, and it definitely looks like a one-to-one copy of a real meeting invite that many people might have seen hundreds of times already. I mean, I for sure have so. And that adds to the whole trust level. You kind of know where to click. And if you do click the button to add or join the meeting, the end user actually ends up being redirected under either webex.com or cisco.com to a newer URL, which then redirects to a malicious file. And this means that the user will see a notification that this trusted website wants to download a file called webex.exe, and a text in the background, of course, already tells you you might need to install the meeting client if you haven't done so. If you haven't used the WebEx browser client for a while, then you might actually think, oh, this is legitimate, I have to update it. But of course, this time, it is not the real meeting client, but actually a Trojan horse.
Yeah, I mean, I can see why people might be fooled by this, especially if you use WebEx in work and you get these meeting invites several times a day. You might just open one and click on it automatically without even thinking, especially if it looks exactly like a legit meeting invite.
Absolutely. And you might think, oh, I missed that one. It's 5 minutes before the hour. So you click on it without really thinking twice about it. And as you said, once you install the supposed client, you actually activate the threat. So the malware itself will then enable remote desktop sharing and also enable the webcam, kind of similar to WebEx meeting, but of course with a real malicious intent behind it. And it also can download further payloads, execute custom commands on the victim's machine, and the threat even tries to steal local passwords. So it's definitely something you do not want to have on your computer.
Yeah, definitely a meeting you weren't expecting and one you probably wouldn't want to attend. Have you any advice for people to kind of avoid being fooled by these kinds of scams?
I guess, kind of as always, be skeptical with any suspicious email. So in recent times, we have seen many spam campaigns misusing Google Calendar invites. And now, of course, those WebEx invites go into the same direction. So therefore, check twice if you receive an invite from an address that you do not know or one that you didn't really expect a meeting from. Also, if the website prompts you to download any, let's say, video driver or special client, please double check that this really is the original software and maybe even decline it and go directly to the website just to be on the safe side. And of course, make sure that whatever email and endpoint protection solution you use can block the threats. So for example, of course, Symantec solution can detect and block those threats.
Yes, indeed. Okay, thanks, Candid. That's about all we have time for this week. If you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of the action and future. You can follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel or Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found at symantec.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again next week when we'll be once again looking at what's going on in the world of cybersecurity. Until then, thank you and goodbye.